Hey, here we are again for another edition of Old School Guns, the podcast that has the information you want. News, Second Amendment issues, commentary, and questions and answers to get you the information you need. First, let's get right to it. As you probably well know, every once in a while, Hillary Clinton, an enemy of gun owners, pops up in the news, and she essentially makes some fool statement. And it's usually regarding the election. And here's something she hasn't gotten. So I've got a little message for Hillary. Dear Clinton, you lost the election. It was yours to lose. You lost it. It wasn't the Russians. It wasn't incompetent staff. It wasn't anyone but you. You bear the responsibility. You are a bad candidate. You were a bad candidate, starting with the ridiculous reset button, Benghazi, and then the email fiasco, and all the other things that have been attached to you over the years that people have proven but nobody ever wants to pursue. You were a terrible candidate. It was yours to lose in 2008, and you lost it to a rookie senator who basically voted present most of the time rather than take a stand on the issues. And as a result, we got 8 years of a lousy president, Barack Hussein Obama. His presidency was as a direct result of your incompetence. You ran again in 2016. You're a terrible candidate. You were hiding medical conditions. You had all this baggage. And more importantly, you proved you were not the person who could take the phone call at 3 a.m. and respond. Benghazi proved that. You lied to the families, then you lied about what they said. I mean, it's just a terrible, terrible thing. You shouldn't have been nominated in the first place, and you wouldn't have been if the system of superdelegates in the Democratic Party wasn't rigged to ensure you the nomination. Mathematically, no one could challenge you. You got it, and then you blew it in the general election. You blew it with a guy who was a novice politician who just outworked you. All he did was outwork you, and that's what it is. So you lost it. Be gone. Retire. And we don't need to hear from you anymore. We really don't. Some other things that are going on. It seems that Representative Sewagewell, the Californian who's running for president, tried to hold a rally outside, an anti-gun rally outside of NRA headquarters, and guess what? Zero people showed up. Actually, I think that it looked like there were less than a dozen. And, of course, Mr. Sewagewell is polling zero. So, you know, this just goes to show you. It's going back to what I said in an earlier podcast that, you know, I think if they want to make gun control a central issue, that's going to be a loser for them. There's not a lot of enthusiasm for it. Now, that could always change with some tragedy or some other thing going on. But really, Americans don't want to be disarmed. And they don't like the thought of total confiscation, which is really what the Democrats are talking about. You know, they're no longer, it's amazing that in the 1960s, all they talked about were handguns. You know, get these evil handguns off the street and blah, 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 on and on, for years. They don't even talk about them anymore. Now they talk about, with these military-grade weapons where, and I've said this before, every weapon is a military-grade weapon. It uses the same high quality steel. In many cases, it uses proven designs that were either created for or used heavily by military weapons in the past, and sometimes even in the present. So, you know, that's what they're harping against now, but it's the same hollow thing, and you know, unfortunately, there are no more Blue Dog Democrats, kind of the conservative Democrats, who would speak up against some of this nonsense. But they're talking about total confiscation. I mean, they think what New Zealand went through was total confiscation. It really was not. But they think it was. And that's what they're pushing, and that's what Americans are pushing back against. And they don't like the threats. They don't like sewage well threatening to nuke people. Even though I think he was so inarticulate, that's I don't know that's what he meant. But he's so stupid, that's how it came out. Some of these other things that the anti-gun politicians are saying is we'll just take them, you know, we'll have police go house to house, all this kind of stuff. So I think the Democrats are definitely losing it, and it's just not going to be a winning issue at all for them. In some other news, I've been checking out, you know, some of this NRA dissent, and I talk about it almost every podcast. And, you know, I recently looked at the two-hour YouTube show or YouTube film, whatever you want to call it. It was really more like a podcast. And it had several of the disgruntled people. It had the little guy from Military Arms Channel. It had Ron Pincus. It had a couple of these other content providers. And they're all on there. And it had Jeff Knox, who was the son of Neil Knox, who I always kind of admired. Neil Knox was a very principled pro-gun guy. And, you know, he was in kind of in the NRA hierarchy, and, you know, he got pushed in, pushed out, in, and then pushed out again. So, you know, they have these guys, and really, in listening to their arguments, there's really no there. I come across, I listen, and they got decades-old beefs. You know, the guy from Military Arms Channel, well, I hate Wayne LaPierre ever since the Hughes Amendment in 1986, which, if you know the Hughes Amendment, there was the Gun Owners Protection Act. It really gutted the very onerous Gun Control Act of 1968 and got rid of a lot of the garbage law that contained. And at the very end, there was a nebulous voice vote that passed the Hughes Amendment, which closed the NFA registry for transferable Class 3 weapons, essentially. I won't go into all that. There's all this stuff, but I won't go into it, but that's essentially what it did. And he says, well, I've hated him since that. And I'm like, dude, this is 32 years ago. I mean, 32 years ago. I agree, the NRA probably did fumble the ball on that. They probably should have had Ronald Reagan, probably should have advised him to veto it, send it back, have that stripped out, pass it again, and make sure there was no Democratic chicanery to attach that lousy Hughes Amendment. And that would have been a lot better. But I think they were so excited to get anything, and they knew that this thing would basically tear apart the 68 Gun Control Act, that they were so excited to get it that they took it, and it was a bad choice. But I don't think it was a malfeasant choice. It was an error, not a calculated move, and it certainly wasn't the type of thing that they deliberately want. And in retrospect, it was a big mistake. But, you know, the Military Arms Channel guy has to understand that back then, there was only modest interest in Class 3 weapons at that time. I mean, the big push, it was, if you collected guns, you collected Colt single actions or Winchester rifles or pre-64 Winchester Model 70s, things like that. It was really more sporting arms from the bygone era that were very, very popular then. Class 3 and military weapons, much less so. And we've seen that basically reverse, so that I don't really know anybody who collects pre-64 Winchester Model 70s, I don't anymore, or, you know, and Winchester rifles, the old ones from the 1800s are a little pricey to collect, any number of them anyway. So, you know, but military weapons have come in surplus in large part thanks to the legislation passed in 1986. So, you know, that's where the collecting focus is, and there's a big interest in fully automatic and other weapons, which has driven the price up. And I understand him being PO'd about that, but really his beef with the NRA is decades old. And same thing with these other guys. They were talking about, well, you know, this guy was the publicist for Heston, and he brought him into the NRA, and all. You know what? That's probably all true. And Charlton Heston was flown around on private jets, he was driven around in limousines, and he was treated like royalty. And that was because without Heston, without his persona, without his fame, without his name recognition, without the way he presented himself in public, we would have no gun rights today. We would have absolutely no gun rights today. And Bill Clinton, even with his impeachment and everything else, was a highly popular president in certain sectors of our population. And basically, we had to have something equivalent to go up against him. Had to have it. And Heston was the right guy at the right time with the right message and could convey it in the right way. So we have our guns today because of Heston. I mean, I'm fully convinced of that. So yeah, he did get treated like royalty. Does LaPierre and Cox and all the rest of them deserve to be treated like royalty? Well, probably not. I've never even heard of this Carolyn Meadows, who's now the president of the NRA. She's another figurehead. She's a figurehead, in my opinion, without any standing, because nobody's ever heard of her. At least I haven't. So, you know, again, she's part of the machine. And, you know, when you talk about the things that are wrong with the NRA, hey, yes, they do hire lawyers, they do these things, they're lobbying, they're doing all this kind of stuff. You know, they have to know. They move in those Washington circles, and you're not going to take a guy like the Military Arms Channel guy or YouTube content creators. You're not going to take those guys and put them in charge of the NRA and think it's going to be effective. They have to know how the system works, who you can talk to, who you can't, what you can say to them, what you can't. There's a whole, not only is there a whole, all these nuanced things, the art of doing this, but there's also a lot of legislative things. You can't go up there and threaten somebody. You can't go up there and make them an offer. You can't offer a quid pro quo for a vote. You can't. There's a lot of things you cannot do, and I'm not read in on that. I mean, you'd need a very strong legal background. So there's things that they can do, certain things that they can't do. And these guys on YouTube, you know, you might be a good YouTube guy, and you may know how to make videos and all that, but guess what? You don't know how to operate in Washington. You just don't. So we've got people who do. And this goes to what I was talking about last podcast, where there is a kind of a contract between the NRA and its members. And we do have to make sure they live up to the contract. We send them a certain amount of money, whether it's an annual or 5-year or lifetime membership, and then, you know, whatever donations we want to give them. We send them that. And they protect gun rights. And, you know, we kind of give them that latitude. Bump stocks was a fight they chose not to do. And you can agree with that or disagree with that. Personally, I agree with it. Bump stocks are for morons. And everybody frickin' knows it. Now, we should have traded it for something like reciprocity. And I did not mangle it that time. So we should have traded it for that, but we didn't. So we just kind of gave it up. But that's okay. That's okay. We can come back from that. We didn't really lose anything with bump stocks. And so I think it's pretty good. Red flag laws, you know, a lot of those are state level. And I don't know that the NRA can affect it. They can with a state level. And face it, you know, they're strongly affiliated with a lot of state organizations. So, you know, they could provide some help there. But that's going to be kind of a local fight for everybody. And you got to look at your state and look what they're doing. Because I don't think there'll be national red flag laws. These are going to be state red flag laws. And the NRA is mostly a national organization, although they do get involved in some state fights. And a lot of the smaller gun control organizations get involved in some state fights. And we'll see, you know, I'm hoping that they get more aggressive. I would like to see the NRA more aggressive. I don't know they can afford to be. I don't know that they can sustain monetarily 10 or 12 lawsuits going on at any one time, suing people in Minnesota for this, you know, the gun controllers in Minnesota for this, or Colorado for that, or something else. I don't know they can sustain that. I don't know any national organization can really do that. Some of those fights are going to be left up to state organizations and the smaller state and local organizations. So That's kind of what that is. And, you know, I just think some of this dissent is, my skeptical human nature is, it's a lot of it getting cheap shots in. I can remember, and this is years and years ago, an NRA field rep visited a gun club that I was a member of. And one of the questions he was asked was, you know, why is it I'm getting something in the mail twice a month or once a month or whatever the spacing is? Why am I getting these things asking me to respond and send them money? Why am I getting these? And the guy essentially said, well, because they work. And they go, when we put out a call for donations or to help support us, and we do that direct mailing campaign, that thing, it pays for itself over and over and over, and we get a lot of money from that. And so it's become a very important part of our fundraising. And so that's kind of why that is. And I knew a lot of guys who didn't like that. They absolutely felt that, you know, somebody was going to the well all the time. And you put that feeling in with the and I heard rumors about, you know, limousines and all this other stuff years ago. And so, you know, you have this kind of these urban myths of they're living like kings, they're living like rock stars, and, you know, they do live differently than we are because they're in a whole different environment. So that's kind of where I am with this NRA stuff. I think these guys on YouTube made fools out of themselves. They don't have a cogent point. They don't have, it's a bunch of guys with a bunch of different gripes and different beefs, different grievances, and they've kind of banded together. And I still think they're pipsqueaks. I mean, I don't think very much of them. I mean, every organization has its flaws, and every organization has made mistakes. And I say that, and I'm not the biggest Wayne LaPierre fan. I don't know the man. I kind of met him once when I was at an NRA annual meeting, and you know, he and Chris Cox is a very nice guy. People who've met Wayne LaPierre say he's a heck of a nice guy, and you really wind up liking him, and he seems very, very committed. The fact that he's not perfect is just, I don't know, that's just a part of what goes on. None of us are perfect. So, in my view, the smartest thing we can do with an upcoming election and everything is band together, protect the second as much as we can, and, you know, should we prevail in the next election, then I think we have a year or two where we can sort some of this out, and maybe somebody has to go, maybe somebody should be held accountable. But right now I think we're all in the same boat, and I think that boat, you know, is going to be under some attack by the Democrats, as I was speaking before. I don't think it's going to be as big as what they would like it to be and what they think it can be. But if the NRA can kind of pull its stuff together, if these dissenters can at least just kind of hold back a little bit, I think we'll be in a much better position and a much better place. So that's my biggest Second Amendment thing for today. The other is, you know, continually Facebook is a serious problem. For gun owners, I mean, they shut down those groups at the slightest provocation. There's a lot of trolling goes on, a lot of just kind of clickbaiting. And I've talked about this before, you know, half of those pictures of saying, this is my gun and I just bought it. How did I do? Well, those things are just, you know, trolling for comments or trolling, trying to get people to respond, because I guess some of these guys, you know, they get enjoyment out of that. They get their jollies out of that. Hey, I got 50 responses on some bogus question I posed. But anyway, I just think that whole thing's a toilet. And frankly, it's not worth talking or responding to. You want to sign up for the groups, I kind of sign up for them, and then I just don't post anything or reply or do anything. I just kind of look, and maybe some of it's interesting, but a lot of it's trash. So I think it really does. You know, Facebook, anybody who bought stock in that probably made a mistake. I have a funny feel. A lot of the younger people are opting out of Facebook, and they go to Instagram or something else. And I don't really think Facebook's going to be around in I think 5 years it'll still be hanging on, and in 10 years I think it'll be gone. It'll be kind of like Apple iPods, you know, you don't see those anymore. And I think it'll be the same thing. It'll be overcome by some other. There'll be something else that replaces it, and frankly does a much better job. So I think that's what's going to happen there. All right, I'd like to get into some. My favorite part, the best part of the show for me, the Q&A. And I really enjoy this. And the first question I have is about 223 versus 556. What is the big difference, and why can't I interchange ammunition between the two? Okay. Now this comes up, and people discuss this. They even discuss it where I work. Essentially, if you have a 223 marked gun, your chamber is of a certain dimension, and that dimension will handle 55 grain bullets. It'll probably chamber 62 grain bullets, and it'll fire those. Anything larger, the neck and the throat is too short, so that the longer bullets will not seat correctly. They'll go right up into the rifling of the barrel. The lands in the grooves, and what that causes is potentially excessive pressure, okay? That's why they recommend you not shoot heavy bullet 5.56 loads in 223. Now, there are several remedies for this. One of the remedies is there's a chamber called the 223 Wilde, the W-Y-L-D-E, and that'll open up the throat so that you can put in kind of whatever bullet you want. I think up to about 75, 77 grains. I know that some people are experimenting with 80 grains, and I don't know if that makes a real difference. I don't really go up that high. 77 is the highest I've gone in a 5.56. A 5.56 chamber is already opened up like that, and the next key with that is what barrel twist do you have? If you have a 1 in 12 twist, it makes no sense to open up the throat, because 55 grain is really the optimal bullet weight for you. The 62 grains won't even stabilize. There's just not enough twist in that barrel. So for 1 in 12, and those of us with older ARs have those, 55 grain is the deal. If you are shooting in a more modern AR and you want to use heavier bullets, there's 1 in 9, there's 1 in 8, and 1 in 7. 1 in 7 was really designed to stabilize the tracer rounds the military uses. Very long rounds because they got the tracer compound in them. But you can stabilize about everything else with 1 in 8. And again, I measured my AR-15A2 one time, and it came out to 8.25, and that was using that kind of primitive measuring technique of using a cleaning rod and a tight-fitting patch. So I'm somewhere between 8 and 8.5, and that's another unknown secret, is that they may say that this is a 1 in 8 twist, but it could be as low as 7.75, or it could be high as 8.25. You know, they're not always exact, and measuring them is very difficult. So I can go up to 77 grains, and my rifle shoots very, very well. 1 in 9, I think you have a good chance of getting the 65s and 68, I think 68 or 69 grain bullets to stabilize very, very well. And one of the things that's predicated on those length, this is talking 20-inch barrels. When you start talking about the shorter barrels, you could have some problems, no matter what the twist rate is, with the heavier bullets, simply because they haven't, they're spinning, but they don't have the length of the barrel to really get them going and get them spinning. So if you have a 1 in 9 16-inch barrel, you might not be able to stabilize the same bullets you could with a 1 in 9 20-inch barrel. 1 in 8 is about optimum, and it'll take you up to 77 grains. And those are the keys. You know, it really doesn't matter what it's marked. It really matters more what you're shooting in it. I will tell you, unless I'm doing some sort of accuracy or some for some odd, unless it's for some odd reason, and I do this occasionally, I essentially load for accuracy and longer ranges, and so I'll go up to 77 grains, and also just out of curiosity sometimes. But for almost all the rest of my shooting, I just use 55 grain. I mean, it's economical, it's available. Once you sight your gun in, it's great. Is it going to shoot the tightest groups at the longest range? Well, no. But it, for most uses, it's going to do just a great job and be just fine. So I stick with 55 grain, and then I don't have to worry about the rest. I really don't. It shoots well out of all twist rates, and it really shoots well out of all barrel lengths. So that's kind of what I go with. So that's my take on the 5.56 versus 2.23. Let's see. Oh, the next one. One of my favorites is, why do they call it a 38 special when the bullet is 357? Why do they do this? Why don't they just call it a 357 special? Then we have the 357 Magnum. Okay, going back to the naming convention of cartridges gets a little complex, and we'll start with the easier examples, and there are all kinds of anomalies out there, but I'll just stick with some of the easier to understand examples. Okay, after the Civil War, basically they started coming up with metallic, self-contained metallic cartridges for rifles, and they had a naming convention where they would do caliber and the number of grains of black powder. So you had 50-70 U.S. government. 50 caliber bullet, 70 grains of black powder. Later they had 45-70, 45 caliber, 70 grains of black powder. They had 45 Colt, which they just called it that. They didn't put the number the amount of powder on there. Then we had 44-40, 44 caliber, 40 grains of black powder. Then they changed it up and went, we had 38-40. Logic would tell us that's 38 caliber with 40 grains of powder. But in fact, it's reverse. It's 38 grains of black powder and 40 caliber. So a 38-40 is actually a 40 caliber. So if you can kind of remember that as an anomaly, you're going to be good to go. So then we come with, why did they have 357, which is 36 caliber? Why did they call it 38 caliber? And why did we stick with that for so long? Well, it's because they measured differently, and it was how they measured. If you measured the outside of the cartridge case, it's 379, 38 caliber. If you measure the bullet, it's 357. So when they first were naming these things, they named it 38 special because, and there had been 38 long Colt, 38 short Colt. It wasn't just one cartridge. Anything called 38 was usually a 357 bullet or a 359 type bullet, you know. So they called them all 38s. They were, in point of fact, if you measure the bullet, it's a 36, but 38 stuck. In 1935, to differentiate the new Magnum cartridge, instead of calling it a 38 Magnum, they called it a 357 Magnum to differentiate it. And that's why that confusion is there. Rifle calibers kind of went on the same way. After the 45-70, we had the 30-40 U.S. government, known as 30-40 Krag to civilians. And that was in the Krag rifle that was adopted by the U.S. military. And that was a 30 caliber rifle with 40 grains of the then new nitrocellulose smokeless powder. So that kind of followed the convention pretty well. There are other ones that come in there, but, 30-30s and 32 Winchester specials and all that, some of those were just hung on there. Some of them were just names that were given, really didn't relate to a lot of things. Then we have the 30-06. Now you'd say, well, what is that? 30 caliber with whatever an aught-six amount of powder is? And the answer is no. That is actually 30 caliber. An aught-six was the shortened version of a date, 1906. There had been an earlier 30-03, but they changed the bullet profile, and they had to lengthen the throat a little bit. Like I was talking about with the 5.56223, they had to kind of open up that chamber a little bit to get the newer bullet in. So we had 30-03, and then we had 30-06. Aught-3 meaning 1903, aught-6 meaning 1906. And I think I actually have that backwards. I think the aught-3 chamber was larger, and they actually had to set the barrel back and then recut it for aught-6 because aught-6 was shorter. So that's effectively the naming conventions of some of these really kind of confusing cartridges that are out there. And I hope that helps out. Let's see, another question is, what is my favorite pistol or revolver cartridge? And I have to say, that takes me a long time, but I have to say, I have the weirdest choice. It is the weirdest choice, but I will say 45 Auto Rim. And for those of you who've never heard of it, 45 Auto Rim is essentially a 45 ACP, automatic Colt pistol, that has a large rim on it, so you could use it in the Smith & Wesson and Colt 1917 revolvers. And there have been a few other revolvers for it, too. The Smith & Wesson 625-2, and as a matter of fact, older was the Model 25-2. It was a very popular cartridge. It was designed so you didn't have to hassle with the half-moon clips or plucking the 45 auto cases out of a revolver when you're shooting. So it's very cool. In many ways, it's sort of reminiscent of a 455 Webley, you know, kind of a stubby little round that shoots a 45 caliber or thereabouts bullet. So I really like it, though. It's fun to shoot. The cool part about them is, in the old Smith revolvers and in the old Colt revolvers, and especially in the newer revolvers, and I don't think anybody but Smith & Wesson has really built any. They are deadly accurate and fun. I mean, low recoil, very accurate, shoots a big bullet. And I also actually use them. I have a converted Webley, and I use it in that also. And it's just about, if you load a target load, if you hand load a target load with a 200 grain bullet, you really are right into what that Webley can handle, because 45 ACP factory loads, 230 grain service loads, are really a little too much for it. So for any kind of shooting, it's a great round in the older frail guns like the Webley, or the newer guns, which are really made for accuracy, and it really does deliver. So that is my favorite round. I don't shoot it as much as I'd like to there, because there's so many other great rounds too, depending on what I'm doing. And a converse question to that, what is my least favorite pistol or revolver round? And that is going to be a lot more difficult, but I will hold this to cartridges that are widely available. Because you could easily say, hey, it's 9mm Largo because it's hard to find, or it's 30 Luger because the companies don't load it to very good specifications, and sometimes it'll function, sometimes it won't. But I'll hold this to the commonly available calibers. And I'd have to say my least favorite to shoot is 357 Magnum. And here's my reason for this. The juice is not worth the squeeze. And now everybody in the self-defense realm and all kinds of 357 lovers, of which I am one in many ways, will tell me how bogus that is. But here's what I will tell you. Most 357 revolvers use 38 special ammunition, and in some cases 38 special plus P ammunition. And a lot of them don't really use the owners choose not to shoot the Magnum ammunition in it. Why is that? because it's got a lot of muzzle blast, a lot of recoil, and it's loud. And all of those things do not go together to make it for a pleasant shooting, even though they can be exceptionally accurate. One of the big fallacies was that, well, you can shoot 38s in 357. Some 357 revolvers don't shoot 38s that well, because really they're set up and it's the barrel twist and it's the longer chamber. They don't really turn in. They turn in decent, but not great accuracy. And I'm sure there are exceptions to that. But when I take a K38 out, it'll shoot the pants off of a 357 Magnum revolver. The only time the 357 is equivalent to it and can shoot as well is when I'm using Magnum loads. And I'm probably not going to shoot 200 Magnum loads in an afternoon. I'm just not. So I would have to say my least favorite is probably 357 Magnum, and a lot of people will disagree. It's a great round for defense. It's a great round for a lot of things. Handgun hunting game that's appropriate for it. I actually knew a guy who used to take white-tailed deer with one. I don't know the legalities of that now. I really don't do much hunting, but it's a great gun, and there are so many great guns for it. When you look at the Smith & Wesson Model 28, you know, the Highway Patrolman, you know, what a great gun that was. And of course the Model 27, which was had the very nice finish, and the Colt Python, you know, great guns. Even some pedestrian guns. Ruger Blackhawk is a great gun in 357, and you can get the 9mm cylinder for it. And Ruger makes double action. Everybody makes a double action 357. Anybody who makes revolvers makes a double action 357 somewhere, I think. And it's a I think they're still pretty popular with cowboy action shooting. I think a lot of those are 357s that they shoot the very light 38 loads in. So, you know, I'm sure there are a lot of them out there that have never seen a 357 Magnum cartridge. The other thing about it is 357 will lead. If you shoot a full Magnum lead bullet, man, that thing will lead the barrel. Woo! Yeah, you got to clean that out. As a matter of fact, that was one of the early... one of the very early criticisms of it is, hey, it shoots great for about 10 rounds, and then you've got this coating of lead in the barrel. And that helped push the jacketed bullet technology a little bit farther, because they realized, hey, this is a serious limitation. So that's my least favorite. Okay, next question is, what is the easiest cartridge you have ever hand-loaded, and what is the most difficult? Well, I think easiest is pretty easy for me to answer, and that is 45 ACP. I've got a Dillon machine set up for that. Can crank out, if I have the bullets and I have all the supplies and the powder and everything, you know, you can just sit down and crank out bullets. You can crank out, you know, several hundred a night. I don't really believe in, you know, doing it so fast that you go crazy. I don't care if I load 100 rounds an hour, 50 rounds an hour. I don't care. As long as I'm loading steadily and I load for, say, 2 hours or 3 hours, you can, in a week, you can crank out more than you probably would shoot in a year of one caliber. But 45 is there. It's the dies are very well made for it by all the manufacturers. And it's large. Not too much goes wrong with it. It's firing it is pretty easy on the brass, so you don't have a lot of case splits or separations. So I think 45 ACP is by far the easiest. Okay, what is the most difficult to load? That is an easy one. The most difficult cartridge I've ever hand loaded is the 577 450 Martini Henry. And I say this because you economically, unless you're Daddy Warbucks, you cannot afford factory ammunition. They want like $120 for 20 rounds, and that's on the low end. Sometimes you can pay $80 for 10 rounds. I mean, it's expensive. So you have to make your own ammunition. The problem is there are not any economical cases. Sometimes 20 cases will cost you $125 or even more. So you're not going to load a lot of it, and cases are very hard to come by. And I can tell you this, I did find some cases for about $50 about 10, 12 years ago, 20 cases. And when you crunch one of those in the loading process, it does bring a tear to your eye. So what you have to do is get 24 gauge CBC all brass shotgun shells, and you take that and you have to form it into 5.77 450 Martini Henry. Now, I cannot afford these $150 or, well, there's an RCBS set of dies that'll do the forming and trimming, but $550 was, about $500 more than I could and wanted to spend on this project. So I decided I would have to find a cheaper way, and basically I discovered a few things. One of them is if you take the RCBS bullet puller die and you take the bullet puller mechanism out of it, it just kind of unscrews and there's a little collet in there and that falls out. That die body will size and provide you an intermediate step, because if you just take the shotgun shell and ram it into the Lee die for 577 450 Martini Henry sizing die, some people have done that, but I have never had any luck. I get creases and folds and it wrecks the case. And even those cases are not cheap. They're a buck a piece, which is not bad, but you lose 10 of them out of 25, and all of a sudden it becomes uneconomical to do that. So I had to get a couple of intermediate dies, and I just came up with some that I kind of cobbled together. So I'm doing this on the complete cheap. So what I do is I take it and I form the case inside the bullet puller die, which just by luck has the correct shoulder geometry, puts the correct shoulder geometry on that case. And I use a fired case to measure, and I go slow, and I put it in and maybe go an eighth of an inch, another eighth of an inch, look at it. When I get that shoulder at just the right place, using a fired case as a reference, then I go ahead and I use a 5070 die, sizing die, to squeeze the top part of the case down to the shoulder even a little bit more. And I'm using Imperial sizing wax die to do this, because other people use the spray-on stuff, but I don't see how that works. You're going to wind up with problems. But this stuff is really, really good. The Imperial is really good. And get it off of Amazon cheap, $10, and you have a tin that'll last you for years. After I use the 5070 die, what I like to do then is cut it to length, and I use a Harbor Freight chop saw. Now, that does not do the greatest job cutting sometimes, so what I have to do is kind of clean up the cut with a Dremel tool. It just takes maybe 30, 40 seconds each case. Remember, you're not going to load thousands of rounds of this. You're not going to be at Rorke's Drift fighting off a Zulu MP. This is kind of a gun you shoot. When you shoot 20 rounds out of it, you're pretty much done. So anyway, I basically clean that up. Then I go ahead and I put it into the Lee sizing die and just very carefully squeeze it down from its 50 caliber down to about 40, down to the 45 caliber, the 450. And I'm sure it's larger in the end. I'm really probably squeezing it down to 460 or something. And if I measured the outside diameter. So I go ahead and I do that. And then I basically make sure the overall length and all that is good. I deburr the case, and then it's ready to go. Now, I do anneal the cases. I kind of left that step out. I only anneal them once. I basically use a little torch and a little pot of water, and I do that at the very beginning. I anneal the cases. That's why I forgot to add that step in. That's usually the first thing I do, is I'll anneal a box of these things, and then I'll go through the forming process. From there, it's pretty basic. I go ahead and they take a large pistol primer. I use a large pistol magnum primer. I use 80 grains of 2FG powder. I put in, now that's not going to fill it all the way up to the neck though. That's going to leave a space, and you shouldn't really leave a space in a black powder cartridge. I don't know why, but you shouldn't. It can ring the chamber in some of the older guns, I understand, but just to be safe, I take some cornmeal and I fill it up to the bottom of the neck, and then I usually use a 480 grain bullet. I have bought them from Buffalo Arms, but you can cast a 500 grain Lee bullet and get about the same thing. SPG lube, I put it in there and I crunch it down in there and I get just a little bit of compression on it, and then crimp it and it's good to go. My rifle, I'm very lucky, has basically a 4.59 bore, so I don't really need to paper patch them. I might experiment with that if I need to improve some accuracy. And I'm really just kind of in the slap steel at 200 yard mode with these loads. So, you know, believe me, these are not scientific, go win the Black Powder Cartridge National Championships loads. But I'm able to crank them out pretty effectively and pretty cost effectively for the most part. Black powder's kind of in it. It's a hassle to get a hold of. I don't really try the substitutes. I use real black powder. I'd like to try to use some 1.5G, but I'm going to have to wait on that because, you know, you can really only buy like 5 pounds of it at a time because of the hazmat. And none of the stores around here, some used to have it, now they don't anymore. And you know, they act really weird about all this. So, you know, I'll get some of that, but it works out really well. I like the fact it uses 2FG powder because that's what I use in my cap and ball revolvers too. So, gives me a powder that I can use in a lot of different things. So that's what I do. I don't paper patch it, and the loads are in there. They're tight, and they seem to work with the primers. So that is about, you know, but that is a difficult process. And I mean, I will spend to get 40 rounds. It'll be an hour or two a night, and I'm basically doing that for like 2 weeks. So I can crank out. And what I do, I don't just take them one at a time like I described. I take a lot of about 5 to 10, and I put them through that process. So they all go through the collet die to get the shoulder correct. You know, I have 10 of those. Then I put the 10 of them through the 50-70 die and all the way through that process. But it's a tough process. Really, though, very rewarding because you feel like you've really accomplished something when you've done that. And it actually makes 50-70 and 45-70, you kind of go, oh, what was that? That's easy. That's easy compared to the 577-450. And to go back to an earlier question, how they named that, I do not know, because it is not a 577 Snyder case merely neck down. It's too long. So it's like a 577 Snyder case that's been lengthened and then necked down. And I mean, and it holds an ungodly amount of powder also. I think it would hold 115, maybe 120 grains of powder if you didn't use the filler. And that would generate some serious recoil. Martini's a very strong gun. I have no doubt it could withstand it. But it's a very, very powerful load. And I think everybody would pretty much agree that it's pretty stout. But the 80 grains, they got some kick to them, but they're pretty manageable. I don't know that I would want to go. You can go down as low as 70 and just use more filler. And maybe I'll try that some point. It just seems that at a certain point it's diminishing return. I mean, what are you really doing? May as well shoot a 45-70 if you're going to go down to that. But the balloon head, they're balloon head cases basically because they're shot shells that you formed. And they seem to last okay. And I think they'll last several firings and be a lot more economical. So that is the most difficult cartridge to load, but definitely the most rewarding, especially out on the range. Well, that's it for Old School Guns. Please follow us on whatever platform you're listening to us on, whether it's Podbean, not Beam, but Bean, or YouTube. We're there. We hope to get a few other places soon, but keep listening. If you like what you hear, you can go ahead and leave comments, and we'll definitely respond to them one way or another. This is Old School Guns, out.